This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bendis and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry, this is a Doxcast, it's a nerdy Toxcast, discuss a Moxcast, with Rich Early and friends.
Hello everybody and welcome to another dynamite episode of the Doxcast. My name is Josh Trumbo and I am your co-host. With me as always is the myopic Richard Early. Rich, how are you doing this evening?
You know, just based on the intro, I can't believe we don't have more listeners. Like, they just need to tune in for the pun every week and find out what it's going to be. So, I'm really good. We were joined by a guest via Skype today, and we're also in studio with Darren Gregson.
Hello, everybody.
And so let's get right to it. Josh, if you want to go ahead and introduce our...
Yeah, so joining us via Skype is the one and only Richard Dent. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, Richard has, Rich, why don't you go ahead and introduce Richard, why he's here?
Well, yeah, so as we were just talking about, reminiscing a little bit, like, the way we met Richard is that he did what a lot of small publishers or small creators, but I don't mean that you're small, you know, starting out creators, boy, I'm so good at this after, you know, like, you've got to get on the phone and you've got to call everybody and you've got to make connections. So, you know, honestly, Richard Dent just reached out to us one day and had a phone conversation with Darren about his book. So that's how we met. That is a grueling task, sir. My hat's off to you.
Are you talking about how I called all the comic book stores in the U.S. and everything like that?
Yep.
Yeah, it was a grueling task. It was terrible. but it was all of that stuff is a learning experience. So I learned a lot about the retail market by doing that. And it was great connecting with certain people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Darren answered the phone here, and it sounds like you guys can, you know, talk quite a bit. So.
I mean, Richard introduced himself and gave me a brief discussion. We had a brief discussion about the book, and I looked on Diamond while he was discussing it, so I had a better idea what it was. I mean, and then when I went home, because I run the Twitter feed, I added you to my Twitter friends and things like that, and it kind of just went from there. And then eventually, I asked if you wanted to be on the podcast. So,
we're going to release this podcast when your book comes out, and we'll talk about that in just a bit. So, I think one of the things that people are really interested in, I mean, here you're not, you're trying to, you know, well, okay. Boy, we can edit that, right? Awesome.
We can, but I'm too lazy to do it.
Yeah, okay. Is how do you know where do I go to how does this all get started? How do I become a comic creator? What happens? So, like, the very first thing for all of us, I think, is, like, Richard, what was your first comic book? Like, what did you read first? What how did you get excited about comics?
I've been Myopia came out in 2016, the first issue, and now this is the second issue. And before then, I had gone to maybe three San Diego Comic Cons. So the culture was really new to me. And as I got to learn more about people who go into comic book publishing, like Nick Barucci of Dynamite, he's loved comics since he was like a little kid and was really into them. I realized that I am not that kind of comic book guy. It was, you know, growing up, I definitely had, was into DC Comics, Superman and all of those sort of things. And then as I was a teenager, I would read Marvel Comics, but I am not the kind of comic book fan that when I was a kid who would go to this comic book store and just hang out there all day long. So, one of the things I've really learned about doing comic book signings is how amazing comic book fans are. They love comics to death, and I do too. But, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like, you know, I was one of those kids because I wasn't. So, as I got older, I got into more sort of graphic novels and comics because I like to read longer works. And I would say my favorite ones that I've read so far is Neil Gaiman's Sandman, The Watchmen, and then I like Persepolis. And I actually like a lot of the stuff that comes from Top Shelf, which is more of like a literary comic book press because they, they're full-on novels. Also, I see in my notes here, when I was a kid, I had this kind of comic book strip that I would always do called Super Dog Cat Mouse. And I would distribute it to my friends. And I basically would make fun of all of the high school administrators and teachers. And I was not a very good kid. So, I mean, I do have a lot of ties to it as a kid, but I would not call myself a traditional comic book kid. But is that a good enough answer?
It's a great answer. Yeah. But so what got you into comics? Like, what changed that then? Like, here you are, you're trying to, you are a working comic professional and publishing books. Like, how did that happen then without that background?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I have, you know, like I said, I am a writer, so I have a background in a lot of different things. So it's not like comic books were completely alien to me. I did read them, and you know, I think when I read The Watchmen years before I even thought about, you know, doing anything in comics, it moved me. So I definitely saw how those how certain comic book series can really reach people and touch people. So I do have a little bit of background, but basically this project came from myopia. So, you know, I have a degree in poetry. I have an MFA in poetry. And when I was in graduate school, I took a year-long screenwriting class. And this was in Arizona. And that was sort of in my subconscious. So basically, when I take on these writing projects or when I write stuff, I write in a lot of different genres. So I have a degree in poetry, but I publish a lot of fiction. You know, I did some screenwriting, you know, and now I'm doing comics, but myopia came from a screenplay that I wrote, and I was sort of like submitting it to screenplay contests. And one of the prizes for one of the contests was to turn the screenplay into a comic book series, a graphic novel. And I was like, oh my God, I'm totally doing that with this. So that's kind of how I am as a writer. When I get something in my head, I just follow it through. So that's how that started.
So were you able to, what's interesting about that, and obviously like storyboarding for movies has a lot of similarity to comics, and developing a story like for a novel or so on and so forth obviously does as well. But there's the graphic form of storytelling. There's the idea that the gutters between the panels are where our imagination carries us between the images. So did you study the art form then, or how did that proceed?
No, writing comic books is very similar to writing poetry and also writing screenplays, as far as how you have that blank space that needs to connect images. And especially poetry, you know, you have these huge breaks in between each line. So, you know, you're sort of taught when you go through a three-year poetry-focused MFA degree how to create lines or images that connect to each other without really, verbalizing or writing down what the connection is. So when I went to write the comic book strip, the comic book, it was actually a lot of fun for me because my brain was already sort of wired that way. Where I was weak, or I think, is sometimes in what is in vogue as far as how things are lettered or delivered in different comic books. I was just reading a bunch of the Valiant graphic novels, and I think it's really interesting how comic book writers tend to verbalize plot a lot. They do a lot of they do a lot of telling, where I, in myopia, I really tried not to do a lot of that. So I see that a lot in comic books, where there's a lot of, exposition about what's going on. But the writers do it in a way where they are clever and amusing, and it really draws you in. And I never even considered doing anything of that nature. So I have a lot to learn still, but I think I was a natural at it because of my background in poetry and in screenwriting.
And I think different writers do it different ways. I think there are a lot of writers that trust the art and don't try to talk over it. But you're absolutely correct that there's a long tradition in comics. If you read Golden Age comics and things like that, the idea was to pack as much material into those 20, 22 pages as humanly possible. And so there were a lot of words because that was value for your money as a reader.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think and I think that I was aware of that when I was writing Myopia, but because of my training in screenwriting to sort of, say less with more, or say more with less, sorry, and that's with poetry as well, I really stopped myself from doing anything like that. But all I was really sort of saying was, now that I've been reading a lot more of comics, I noticed that there's a lot of people who do that, but they do it well. So it works.
That's fascinating. This is a really interesting background and connection to comics and comic writing. You guys got any questions, Darren or Josh?
Well, I was just going to mention, since you were talking about, you know, the kind of show-don't-tell aspect of that. That was one of the things that struck me is in that first issue when we get to see the young child, Matthew, I believe.
Yep.
He hasn't said anything yet. I believe in some of that there's maybe some dialogue that's happening, you know, off camera, as it were. But his scenes are silent. And it's all about the showing the action that's going on there, and you get so much from that. And I think that was a really, really excellent choice because it sets him apart so far from the rest of the action that's going on and the rest of the characters that have been introduced. And that really struck me. So good job.
Thanks. I was just actually thinking, as you were talking about kids in comic books or kids in movies that are like that, but I was thinking about the Terminator, the original one. I don't think that kid said a lot, you know, mm-hmm. during that movie. There was just a lot of him, but he was really smart and made a lot of a lot of the right decisions and that sort of thing. So I don't know, my brain's just sort of going in that.
Yeah, no, that makes and there's a lot of times in comics where, because it's a reading medium, where characters say things that if you said them out loud just sound dumb. wouldn't naturally say, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree, and that's what I was saying before about the voice. Like, if the writer starts out with a voice, kind of like an omniscient narrator voice, that they can jump in and out of the characters and do that sort of exposition, you got to do it from the beginning, and it's going to be a style, you know. And that's just not the style of this book, so.
Yeah. So, my question, I was going to kind of jump to the art, really. Yes. So I was looking on the kick, because it was a Kickstarter, the book, and they had some promotional images on the Kickstarter, but it's actually a different artist than from the final book. Is that correct?
Yeah. So this project has really, I'm not an image guy. I don't, as I was explaining, I don't really have that kind of background in comics, where I know a ton of illustrators and letterers and writers. And this was a real solo project. So when I started off this whole project, going back to that contest that I told you I saw, sure. What I did is I hired that illustrator to draw some pictures for me. And I actually sort of drug him around. I paid him for those. And then I sort of drug him around, like, with my agent looking for a publishing deal. But I was sort of new to the comic book scene, and you just don't really get, and so was my agent, and you don't really get normal publishing deals in comic books. Like, it's a very expensive medium. So there's all these different factors. So, when the Kickstarter sort of ended, I think me and that illustrator sort of just parted ways, because he just sort of assumed things were going to be one way, and I assumed they were going to be the other. Okay. So that was the end of that. But
sure. that makes sense. I mean, so you found Patrick? Is it Patrick Burke?
His name is Anthony Spey, and okay. he's done a lot of stuff for I think Zenscope. He used to work over there.
But then you found Patrick. Is that right?
Well, then when that happened, after the Kickstarter, I just worked with Dynamite, and then they gave me a list of illustrators that they thought would be good for the project, and I picked Patrick out of that one.
Okay, I feel like I can ask this. So you'd started the Kickstarter, but somehow Dynamite got involved while the Kickstarter was...
Yeah, you really you want me to show you my dirty laundry? You're dragging up all my dirty laundry.
No, honestly, I'm just curious. But if it's not something you don't want to show, Richard,
it's fine. So what happened was as soon as I hired this illustrator to create these sample pages, I gave the script and the images to my agent at the time. Okay. And we actually secured a deal with a company called Dabble Brothers.
Okay.
And they worked with best-selling authors, like a lot of the people who supported my Kickstarter rewards. They worked with those authors sort of like making their best-selling novels into comic books.
Okay.
So Dabble Brothers went out of business, and then Dynamite bought that company. Oh. And so I had a relationship with them through that. But it wasn't until after I did the Kickstarter that Dynamite signed me on. So because, you know, I mean, I'm new, so they're not going to they weren't going to just take a gamble on me like they would, you know, Neil Gaiman or George R. R. Martin, who are, you know, super famous best-selling authors. Of course, they're going to take their properties. But funny note, Dabble Brothers, I've seen them around, are coming back again.
Okay. Well, we totally agree with you on how the industry is. It's very different than the book publishing industry. We don't understand the book publishing industry very much, but Darren and I have attended a lot of retailer conventions and things like that with Diamond and with Comics Pro and things like that. And it's very clear that, you know, our industry operates just so differently than what you must be used to if you've been in traditional publishing at all. So, just interested in the differences in your opinion.
Well, the thing about traditional publishing is, like, I'm finishing up this, I'm jumping down your questions a bit, but I'm finishing up a novel right now that I'll just give to my agent, and compared to the process I went through with Myopia, it's simple. It's like you give the book to the agent, he submits it to publishers, they either buy it or they don't. There's some editing done and that's it. The hard part in that is you're writing, you know, a novel, which is like 300, 400, 500 pages, which takes a lot of time. Not that writing a comic book series doesn't take a lot of time, but, you know, you're sort of splitting a lot of that workload with the illustrator. So there is less time involved. There's more planning, but less actual writing. Words, the amount of words that you write. Comic books are expensive, and I've come to really, respect the limitations that publishers have to deal with in generating comics. I mean, you know, you're paying, you know, in my case, you're not paying me because this is my project, but I have a different situation with Dynamite. But if I was a Dynamite owned property, you're paying the writer or any publisher like Marvel or DC, you're paying the writer, you're paying the, you know, the penciler, you're paying all of these people to work on this project. You know, you have to take that into consideration if you're comparing it to regular publishing, how difficult it is to get projects off the ground. I mean, frankly, I'm blown away at how many comic books are out there considering how expensive they are to make, you know. And they're just done, like, some of them on a month-to-month basis. You know, crazy.
It's like a wheel that never stops turning. They've got to pay you. They've got to get it out in the stands, and I've got to pay them, and then I got to get it sold. So, and it just doesn't stop over and over and over again. So, I mean, let's talk about Myopia. Like, we're, you know, like I'm fascinated by the business, but I'm sure you really want to talk about the book. So, you know, let's just tell us about the book.
Well, I mean, the first issue sort of sets everything up, which has been out for a while now. And then this new issue that's coming out is just a continuation of that. It's a dystopian concept. And it's what Margaret Atwood would call speculative fiction, meaning there is parts of it that could happen. Not that she invented that word, but that's where I first heard it. So is through her Handmaid's Tale book. And it's set like 200 years, 300 years in the future. Everybody wears these sort of Google Glass type lenses. Then the government steps in and takes control of the company that makes the lenses and starts sort of manipulating everything everybody sort of thinks and sees and hears. The reason they're doing this becomes more evident as the series progresses. So I'm not going to really talk that much more about it, but that's sort of the world that we're in. The style, I sort of switched from the original Kickstarter. I wanted to do that modern style, but I thought about, as far as illustration is concerned, but I really thought about like some of my favorite science fiction genres. And I thought to myself, then I just sort of thought, you know, how weird it is that people make everybody wear those members only clothes, you know, in all the science fiction sort of things as if, like, in the future, you know, this is going to happen, which in reality, if you look at the future from now, from like 100 years ago, Chrysler's designing cars that have, you know, those weird Chrysler cars that look like old 50s cars.
Yeah,
like,
the PT Cruisers,
you know,
and
like,
stuff.
There's no such thing as a time and place where we're going to get to where everybody's sort of wearing glittery, silver, you know, shiny metallic clothes. So I sort of just thought, you know what, I'm going to do steampunk. I'm deciding that's going to be the style at that point in time. So that's where we, and it's not really steampunk, it's more just a steampunk style to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one of the things I really liked. And I was, you know, when I was talking about your collaboration with Patrick, one of the things I was thinking was, like, how, you know, how much of a collaboration is it? Because, you know, the vehicles, the buildings, the fashion, mm-hmm. They got a very specific look, and he's a very, very talented illustrator. But between the two of you, how did you come up with those kind of images? Was it very much of a collaboration, or did you say, look, this is my idea, and then he came back with the sketches and things?
Well, this is another thing about the difference between comics and regular publishing. Sure. There was a lot of fighting involved.
I'm not deliberately asking questions that are going to cause problems.
No, it seems like that, right? You're doing that. No, I don't mean fighting in a bad way, but I think, like, Patrick was really sort of surprised at sort of like how much input I had on a lot of stuff. But you know, he was great, you know, ultimately about it once we got into a rhythm. But I don't know, I would think, like, I would tell him, you know, very specifically what I wanted. And if he did something that was a little bit different, which he did a lot of times, I would say, great. You know, I mean, he's an artist. I wanted him to enjoy the project as much as I did. So as long as he did everything to the point where the story that I wanted to be told was happening, I gave him a lot of freedom to do what he wanted. He exceeded my expectations. He is very talented. So
excellent. So one thing I've been kind of curious about here, you know, especially with your background in writing novels and poetry, which is a good mix of fairly short form. I guess poems can be longer, but they tend to be a little bit shorter than the novel.
Right.
And then you're finding the comic book, which perhaps is a kind of a middle ground. How much of the story of Myopia do you have written? I mean, do you have, like, an idea of the entire story, what you want to tell? Or is it, here's the idea, I want to see how it evolves and just kind of keep it going as a continuous thing? Where's the story at? You know, is it pretty much set and you just have to get the individual issues out? Or how does that work?
Yes. So I have the first story arc completely finished. We had a real... Patrick was taking a long time with the second issue. So, you know, that's why there's such a lag in between both of them. He just works kind of slow, because he's, I think, because of all the detail that he puts into it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just if you're sort of wondering why it took so long in between issues, so this is going to be a 4-story arc, 30 to 40 pages of each issue. And then I have a outline for another, sort of story arc that I sort of, as it comes to me, I make notes about it. And it usually comes to me, I don't know, when I'm trying to procrastinate working on my other projects.
Does this book, is there something that you feel that uniquely allows this book to be a comic book versus a novel? Or was it, you know, just kind of from because of the contest you saw?
Well, I mean, it was the contest that really stuck it in my head, that got it there, planted the idea in my first place. And when I first wrote it, you know, as a screenplay, I really didn't even think about that at all. But, you know, I do live in Los Angeles, and I could have sold that screenplay if I wanted to, or at least tried to. I was a winner in the Austin Film Festival, so I was flown out there and met with producers and talked to them about the script. There was a lot of opportunity there. But I just really liked the idea of it being a comic book, because, you know, the way that film can be so interpreted by a director. It can be a vision that you didn't initially start out to have. Mm-hmm. So I like having things in book form. You know, I have like a control over it. So maybe it's a selfish thing, but I just thought this particular story would be a great comic book.
No, I think I think that's the reason that a lot of creators, comic book creators, work in that medium because of the control. I mean, I've listened to interviews with writers and artists, well, specifically artists, who say they get a lot more money like working in the video game industry, but then they're just a cog in the machine, like in a bigger machine, you know, and it's...
Yeah, that's a real bad one.
Yeah.
that's really boring. I have a friend who's done that as a writer, and there's just so little creativity because it's all about programming.
Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's one thing that's interesting about the comic medium as well, is that...
No offense to game programmers. I mean, no, I didn't mean it that way.
But that's one thing that always fascinates me about the comic medium itself, is that you have a bit more control over it, but so does the reader. So, you know, if I go to a movie, the movie's going to go along at its own pace, whether I'm there or not. If I have to stop and go to the bathroom and leave the theater, the movie keeps going. But with a comic book... you have that time to really soak it in and go at your own pace. And, you know, and that means some comics you can just fly through because the action leads that way. And sometimes you really need to stop and absorb it. And so I think that's kind of an interesting dichotomy there, where you have more control over how it gets on the page, but less control with how the audience sees it. But I think that's a benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I never even really thought about it that way. I haven't really asked many people how they read comics, but it's a real interesting question to ask people. I sometimes just, when I read a comic book, I tend to just follow the writing, and I rarely linger on the art, which is one of the reasons why I really like working with Patrick, because I feel like his art is so good that even if you're one of those readers, you can't help but stop and be impressed by a lot of his work, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, personally, that's how I feel about it. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm not to make it all about Patrick. I have a background in like graphic design and art. That's why I'm focusing on that. So, you know, the characters look very realistic, but they don't look like photographs or staged. The expressions of the characters are very good, and you know, once you start reading that book, you're immersed in that world because of the designs and everything that he's put together with your words. It just worked really well, I thought.
Yeah. I also think that as I read more comic books, one of the ways that you can sort of bring more attention to the art, and I tried to do this more in the second issue, is doing like those two-page spreads or designing your page and suggesting to the artist a lot of interesting panel layouts.
Yeah.
I've tried to do a little bit more of that. I mean, in the first one, it was interesting because I had the layout was interesting because I had the letters and I had all of that prose information there. But in the second issue, I'm really trying to put a little bit more interesting panel layout, and I will continue to try and do both of those things for the remaining two issues after this one.
I would definitely say I felt the second issue that I could breathe like through the panels better. And it's not that there was anything wrong with the first issue, but like,
well, it depends what kind of, no, I know what you're saying, because it really depends what kind of reader you are. And think like some people will just audit, like when I wrote the first issue, I thought to myself, people are going to either read these letters and it's going to make it a slow read and it's going to be more difficult, or they're going to just see them as letters that they don't need to read and they're just going to sort of read right through it. So you sound like somebody who probably read the letters.
Yeah. Sorry.
No,
I mean,
you're the reader that I really want, right? Because I didn't write them just for, you know, just for fun. But I mean, they were fun to write, but I mean, that's the kind of reader that I aim for.
Yeah.
But personally, I'm not that kind of reader. Like, I would have read it through without reading the letters and went back and read them later. That's what I did with...
Sorry to interrupt you. I mean, when I saw those letters, and I skim read through them but then carried on reading the story, and I felt that they're almost like, you know, at the end of Watchmen, every issue there was like a little supplemental bit.
Yeah.
That, like,
He was smart. He waited till the end to do that.
Yeah. So, like, if you know, I'm into the story. Well, I want to go back and read what it says on these letters because, you know, I'm interested. You know what I mean? I want to know now. Right. So that's what that's how I felt about it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, is this book? Do you have a style as a writer? Do you bring like your personal like beliefs or opinions to your stories all the time, or is this sort of like a unique piece for you?
No. Well, I mean, I guess you know, as a poet, I've always written more personal stuff. That actually I experienced, or, you know, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much where I was coming from. This was my first genre piece, and I love genre, so it was really fun for me to write, but I definitely feel that my feelings about environmentalism came out in this book, which becomes more evident as it goes along, mm-hmm. and sort of like how I feel about, you know, phone culture, technology. Those are definitely, I'm definitely opinionated about how that affects people's, you know, spiritual life and their psyche. So it definitely is a personal, there's a lot of personal feelings that were in that book. But style, I always try and do something different. Like what I'm writing right now is a total, has nothing to do with genre stuff. It's about bartending. So.
And when you are writing this book, do you feel like you're writing it to be a comic book for the sake of it being a comic book? Or did anybody ever say to you, you know, this is kind of a cool concept. Could we get some proof of concept? Because, like, and I don't know if this applies to you, but that's what it feels like a lot from a lot of comics, is that someone's trying out something that a TV producer or movie studio wants to look at, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's gross, you know? I mean, there was whole publishers built around that. I think Radical Publishing was one of those publishers with Sam Worthington's publishing company. I don't know. Like, I'm here. I'm just such a bad shit talker. I'm never going to get ahead with the way I talk about people. I feel like that publishing house was very geared towards that. In fact, they didn't hide it. I mean, they were based out here in L.A., and they did create sort of combined concepts that were comic book / film properties. No, I mean, this was already a good idea for, like I said, this was already a good idea for a movie. So there was really no reason for me to turn it into a comic book. I just wanted to do it because I really liked the story, and that was the only way that I could think about fleshing it out, unless I wanted to become a producer or a director, which I absolutely have no interest in doing anything like that. So it sounds like really a lot of work.
Really, my last question, and I know we're pretty much at time, but I don't know much about your career. Are you at a point where, you know, like, can you tell us where we might have seen things you've written or read things besides a comic book, and just where you're at in your career?
Sorry about that. I'm definitely more of the kind of writer. It's funny you mentioned this. When I was at Comic-Con last year, I went to the Random House party, which is mostly genre writers, and genre novelists, I feel, really judge themselves based on how many books they've published, you know, and because they tend to really crank out novels. But I am definitely like the creative writing professor type writer career. I mean, my whole background is in poetry. I've published poems and short fiction in a lot of different literary magazines. So you'll notice that a lot of the reviews I get from Myopia will be in a lot of like the, you know, Paris Review, not that I got at the Paris Review, but things like the Paris Review or the Virginia Quarterly or that sort of thing. So I am definitely do my own thing. So my work sort of bubbles around in there. This is my first sort of like step into something more mainstream. I wasn't really thinking about it that way, but I guess it is, just by the reactions that my kind of nerdy writer friends kind of have about me doing something like this. So, you know, I guess that's sort of like where I am more, poet. And now I'm doing this. So, like, I guess when you teach, you can do stuff like that because you don't have this pressure of, like, I need to make a living off this immediately. And I like it that way because I feel like that way I can really control the quality better. Like, for instance, if I was trying to make a living as a comic book writer, I'd be very upset right now that there was this huge lag in between my first and second issue, because apparently, from what I was told, that's something that really slows down the momentum for, you know, this is not normally done. But, you know, it's my project and I'm not, you know, I'm not depending on it to pay all my bills. So I'm fine with the way that it's going so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's back to that wheel. I mean, if it's, you know, new comics are out every Wednesday, there's probably 150 books, so it's got to keep coming is the typical thought. But who, I mean, you, things break that rule all the time, so don't worry about it that much.
And I would say, I mean, and I would say, I mean, you know, you're going to have the first four issues, you know, if they collected, eventually when it's finished and they're collected, you're going to have a solid book volume that's going to, you know, it's going to be a good read, you know, so... And no one will care that it was late, because no one will remember, because they'll have that those four issues to read, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's kind of good about comics. You get second chances, you know.
Excellent. Well, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just saying. Did you want to ask me anything else, or is it 45
minutes like
already?
I feel like I shouldn't ask any more questions, because I might upset somebody.
Yeah, Darren's going to have to go sit in the corner for a while.
It's really funny, you know, about all that stuff about the Kickstarter and then the earlier publisher and the illustrator. I have absolutely no problem talking about any of that stuff. The only reason I don't talk about it that much is because when I was pulling the Kickstarter together, there was sort of like this. I was sort of editing the narrative of all of that stuff because it just sort of detracts from what's happening at the moment. But I don't mind talking about it. I think it's really interesting, you know. Yeah. It's really interesting stuff. I mean, the book is definitely gone through a huge journey to get where it's at. So,
well, I think Josh is going to do a few wrap up type questions or things here.
No, one thing I just wanted to say, you know, in addition to thanks for being on, is it's been a really interesting perspective having you on, because we've talked to a few other comic creators, some writers, artists, letterers, and your background is very unique in this, and so we really appreciate you coming on and sharing all this information with us, and. Yeah, so we'll do a little bit of cleanup here. How can people find you, and how can people find Mytopia? Or Myopia?
That's okay. It's funny. I have a lot of people, eye doctors. Sorry. I'll just say that instead.
That's my fault. I tripped you up.
Following me on Instagram because of the title of my book. So people say that name different ways all the time. You can go to richdentwriter.com. That is my web address. And then I just put links there to my Instagram and my Facebook and my Twitter account. And if you do a Google for Richard Dent Myopia, there's been a lot of press on the book, and it will bring it all up, and you'll be able to find me through any of that stuff.
Excellent. Rich or Darren, any last questions or comments here?
No,
my only question as usual is just like, I mean, I'm really focused on trying to inspire people to get out of their shell, to know that it's okay to be them, and to get out and do what they want to do. So, you know, I am just curious, you know, what can you give? I mean, it's the typical writer question, right? Like, what's the advice you could give? But I guess specifically, how does somebody move from not writing to writing, especially by putting themselves out there in, you know, the science fiction genre or things like that?
I don't know. I mean, I think we all get stuck in our little worlds. I know when I graduated, one of the reasons why one of the reasons I stayed with poetry as long as I have when I graduated college was because I was sort of trained to do it. So when I wrote the screenplay, I just was like bored, you know. I was just so sick of writing poetry. I didn't tell anybody I was doing it. I think, you know, for me, when I work on my writing, I just don't like to talk about it until the project is done, because if someone says something to discourage me, it can throw me into a tailspin. And at least, you know, for like a day or two or that sort of thing. So I try not to talk about what I'm doing, and I just sort of do it. But but I don't know, are you asking me how to inspire somebody to break out of a writer's block
what was it for you? Like, what, you know, a lot of us love the idea of writing or want to do it, but like, what was there a moment in your life where you're like, I got to be a writer? That's just the way it is.
No, I mean, I guess I have a different feeling about it. I feel that, you know, if you're a creative person, there's probably a lot of different things you could do with your creativity. I don't know if you can see it. I have a piano in the back here. Like, I played the piano. You know, I like to draw. I did that comic book when I was a kid. Yep. You know, I think if you're creative, you should just do what you want, whatever it is you're doing right now that you find creative. I think you should just do it and see where it goes. If you want to write something like a novel or do a project like that, you have to, at that point, you know, be a little bit honest with yourself about the fact that it takes dedication. It takes getting up every day and just writing, even if you're having a bad day. And it takes a lot of time. You know, there are writers who can just write really fast and get a lot of books out, but I'm not one of them. And I would say 99% of the writers that I know are not those type of writers. So I guess my advice would be creative. If you're a creative person, do what you find joy in, no matter what that might be, whatever genre that might be. And if you decide, hey, I want to take this more seriously, then you have to be honest with yourself and say, okay, I'm going to need to find time every day to do this. You know, I'm going to have to write through all of the mental blocks that I create, because all writers do that all the time. They sabotage themselves. They compare themselves to other writers. And you have to really just, you know, work past that by just writing. I write, walk around the block. Right, walk around the block, because I just need to keep stepping back and pulling myself out of it for a second and reevaluating, okay, is this still going the right way? Am I in the right mind space to be doing this right now? That sort of thing. And if I'm not in the right mind space, I get myself into it, because you can't just wait around for, you know, to be inspired. You have to still work at it.
Well, yeah, it's always fun to read, you know, Stephen King's On Writing is an awesome book, but it's like, I'm reading this book and I'm going, oh, right. You know, like he says, you know, like write a couple hundred pages for your character before you know where they're going. You're like, oh yeah, I can do that. No problem. You know?
Yeah. So. Well, I know. I mean, that's the thing, though. But, you know, genre writers like Stephen King, it's funny. I was just reading this article on the Millions about prolific writers, and the guy who wrote it was really suspicious of them, because I am too. I find people who are prolific, like Stephen King and Joyce Carol Oates, I find them weird to me. I mean, I don't know how anybody could sit down and just write a whole story like that, because so much of my stories are tied into personal experiences. And yep. If you're writing all the time and you're living out in the woods or cabin in Maine or something, you're a totally different kind of writer than I am. You're somebody who is jumping out of stuff that's in your mind only, and I'm not that kind of writer. So I don't understand Stephen King, so I probably wouldn't take any writing advice from Stephen King. but I do
put
like,
that quote, you know, in the podcast.
Here I go. I'm slagging off Stephen King now.
I love it. All right.
Yeah, what you said makes perfect sense.
You know, it makes a ton of sense. Yeah. And again, Josh said this, but it's been fascinating to listen to you. Your perspective is really refreshing and unique and individual, and I really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Is there a movie or TV show your name is on someone can go watch?
Oh, like a writing credit?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, I have been in like as like extras in movies, but I don't think you want to go watch me walk. No, I teach screenwriting. And I live in LA, and I'm around a lot of writers. I have professional TV writers come speak in my classes, and I know a lot of writers. And I've never had the desire to work on a TV show, and I because it's a total different, you know, it pays okay, but it's like you're stuck in a room with a bunch of other writers all day. It sounds like my worst nightmare. You know, I like to work alone, but you know, I've only really written just this one. Like two screenplays, and you know, the one I never really showed anybody, and this one I decided to turn into a comic book, so I've never really pursued that road, but I might, but we'll see. You know,
all right, Richard. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you,
we really appreciate you coming on this podcast. If you're listening to it on iTunes and on our website, it will be out the same week as Myopia number 2 releases. And we here at Paradox will be pushing it. One of the things we want you to know: we're here not for you to help us. We're here to help you. So we want to sell your comic. And we want to, if we can ever help you be a better writer, or you need something, you need to know something about nerds in North Dakota, please give us a shout. And we're going to help you. So,
one of the biggest English populations outside of London, I heard.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you guys for tuning in, whether live or after the fact. Remember, you can always find us, ParadoxCNC.com, at ParadoxCNC on Twitter. We're on Facebook, of course. And if you are in Fargo, North Dakota, feel free to drop down by the shop. Talk with us. We'd love to chat with you about Myopia or any other comic or gaming need you might have. But I think that will do it for tonight. So thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next DoxCast.
This was a DoxCast. Hope you think it rocks cast. Oh, look at the clocks cast. Until next time, geek on.